I'm Sela Satterstrom, and delighted to be here. I think this election, if we can call it that, is different from a description I handed to someone at some point. And in part because it's this today is arising out of conversations I've been having with my Monday MFA class. So I'd like to say thank you to my students and also to the summer writing program, everyone that holds this space and to Ann. It's marvelous to be here. And I should also say I've been kind of hell sick, and so I've taken some medicine that makes me feel like I've had about 15 pots of coffee. It's kind of fun. I don't drink coffee, though, so I'll try to talk slowly. So on that note, in relation to some of this week's concerns, in particular notions of crossing borders, translation, cultural forms, and so on, in thinking about such concerns, I would like to talk about contradiction, diaspora, translation, and the mechanics of binaries in terms of language through the vista of a particular tradition, that being Hoodoo. In one way, I'm responding to this week's lecture opportunity with personal narrative, but I mean strategies on the altar of your consciousness, or that place, that edge place, where we go to look mystery in the face when confronted with the conundrums of our own process. So some basic information about Hoodoo. It's a funny word for a very serious thing, and I'm speaking generally here. It's primarily a tradition that's practiced in the Deep South or elsewhere by people with Southern ancestry. It is a synergistic tradition born of West African, Eastern, and Western European, Native American, and Creole lineages, and is practiced by whites, blacks, and Native Americans. It was well established in antebellum times, during which all of these lineages were engaging, and it, of course, continued to flourish during and after Reconstruction. It is a tradition which was born in and has proliferated in the margins of Southern culture. It is a series of strategies for navigating the margins by using the content of and within the margins. It is a tradition which has bloomed at the intersection of skillful will and magic. Skillful will in this context, meaning working with what you've got to create the most poignant outcome, and magic in this context, meaning the energy of pure possibility. As a tradition proliferating in the margins, it communicates with other traditions also proliferating in the margins. For example, all the way out here in the Wild West in Denver, Colorado, I can go to a Santeria Botanica on Lawrence Street, which serves a Hispanic population, many of whom go to this botanica, which doubles as a community center, to find strategies for health stay once certain borders have been crossed. Though Santeria and Hoodoo are entirely different traditions, they have a long history of speaking to one another across space and the light of the desert and in the midnight darkness of wandering. And in that botanica on Lawrence Street in Colorado, I can ask the root worker there for devil shoestrings, a kind of root popular in Algiers-style hoodoo practiced in Louisiana and Mississippi. And that root worker will know exactly what I'm talking about, and he will have some on hand. He might sell it to me, and we might have a conversation about how it is used in rural Mexico to halt severe cramping, and I might tell him about how in Louisiana and Mississippi it is made into a whiskey tincture to make sure the devil doesn't give you any grief. In Santeria, this root may be used differently, and it is called by a different name. But the border-crossing tendency which saturates hoodoo and its linguistic structure in a kind of DNA way enables it to converse, or at least attempt to, across the borders of culture. It is a linguistic system of desire, innately so, a language of gestures always reaching towards the crossroads, that place where we see into the heart of the matter, our own hearts. Hoodoo participates in a web of margins, and in that web, language arrives, disappears, endlessly exchanges places, shifts as if in a dance. Hoodoo is a recipe-based tradition, and many of its ingredients can be found in your kitchen pantry. It is what happens when you apply what you've got to what you want or need. It is a system often used by people who don't have access, for whatever reason, to other systems and culture. For example, say you are in need of child support but cannot afford a private attorney. In my birth state, Mississippi, there is currently a 15 to 19 year wait to be assigned one of two attorneys who work for the state to review your case. This is because the Department of Human Services went bankrupt years ago and has been operating under the order of the governor and at minimum capacity. So meanwhile, if you want the father of your baby to give you some money, but he won't, write his name over and over again on a piece of paper, and write your name over and over again on top of his name, and stick that piece of paper in a jar of honey, and for 7 days look at it while reciting the 23rd Psalm 7 times in a row. Do this 1 week a month for 7 months. It may sound like a funny thing to do, or perhaps even endearing, but when all you have is a baby, a jar of honey, a Bible, and no damn money, you don't have anything to lose. And when you are in a place of surrender such as that, you become focused within the field of possibility. And Hoodoo writes, anytime you ask for something, you have to ask for it as clearly and as detailed as possible, which requires understanding your situation or your dilemma as fully as possible, which cultivates accountability. And it is crossing the threshold of accountability which initiates one into a very deep experience of empowerment. I was brought up in what you would call a Hoodoo environment. My mother practiced it, as did others in my family, and as a child and young adult, I participated in Hoodoo temples, which are home-based temples. One such temple was mothered by a woman named Sister Mert, who was half white and half Native American. The other temple that was important to me as I was growing up was in the home of the esteemed mother Harriet Crossgrove, a black woman who was a spiritual advisor to 3 generations of my family. Both Sister Mert and Mother Harriet were considered within the marginal communities in that small town as ministers. And in this context, minister means legal counselor, personal advocate, healthcare practitioner, because Hoodoo is also a system of herbalism, community mediator, diviner, spiritual advisor, and logistical problem solver. Like Mother Harriet, my mother was also a diviner. She used regular playing cards, as did Mother Harriet, and so I grew up with that whole experience, too. And I should pause to say a note of gratitude to Catherine Ironwode and Dr. Christos Chioni for their scholarship and dedication to archiving Hoodoo. I've been very grateful to engage with them, and I've learned a tremendous amount. I remember once coming home from a party during my senior year of high school where I'd been drinking hot Schlitz along with the other 10,000 bored and evil teenagers to find my mother in the middle of a reading. I didn't have a curfew, but it would have been hours past mine if I did have one. She was, very much to my surprise, doing a reading for the most popular boy in my graduating class, the star football player, the homecoming king. I was the least popular girl in my class. In fact, that party I mentioned that I had been at, I wasn't even invited to. And I remember opening the door and seeing him, and the look that passed between us as I walked past him sitting at my mother's table as I was en route to my bedroom. He didn't look at me like he was embarrassed, but like he was sad. He had a serious look on his face. And after that, I thought about him differently. Later, my mother told me that death was in his life, just like a person could be in your life, and that his grandmother would die in 2 weeks' time, and then she did. All of which is to say, you'd never know who would come for a reading, or what time they'd come, or for what reasons. Mother Harriet, Sister Mert, and my mother were all insistent in a kind of emotionally violent way in teaching me that judgment had no place in Hoodoo. You didn't judge the person sitting in front of you, whether they were a little too much gin-drinking socialite, a garbage man, a gambling pool shark, a lost high school boy, a drug dealer, an elementary school teacher. Food is food, Mother Harriet would say. What she meant is that in the end, we all put it on the table to eat. Hoodoo is above all practical. It doesn't matter who you are. In the end, life will diversify you. It will humble you. And furthermore, if you want to eat, you have to work. So if someone knocks on the door at midnight in crisis, you open the door and say, "Come on in. I knew you'd come. I've been waiting for you. We've been waiting for you. All the people, the living people, the dead people, we've been waiting for you to come back into yourself, to come home." I didn't question all of this when I was growing up. It didn't seem weird. Not until I brought my first serious boyfriend home from college and my mother somehow secretly extracted one of his hairs and with other ingredients, used it to make what is called a hand, sometimes also called a Toby or Mojo bag. Using this personal concern, she did this. On our second day home, she presented to him as if it was a gift. He thought that was weird. Oh well, he still dated me for 3 years. I have since investigated it with my intelligence, through research and scholarship. Hoodoo is an oral tradition primarily, and so many of my investigations have been extended ruminations on the category of history, as in, who gets to write it and why? Several years ago, I came across an Antebellum Hoodoo recipe that reignited my interest in it. And this recipe was from the Storyville District of New Orleans around the turn of the century about how to attract business to a whorehouse. And so the recipe, in case you need to know this information, which you don't know, you take pink sugar and put it in a man's shoe, go in the backyard on a Friday and burn it while reciting particular psalms. So it was the beginning of me becoming obsessed with the language of this tradition, which is a tradition very much obsessed with language. I want to consider this obsession today as a way to explore what it suggests as a strategy for investigating language, for investigating reading as an act of encounter, and as a strategy for writing. Having listed some elements of Hoodoo, it can still be asked, what exactly is it? We can't even get through the density of the question before we become lost or distracted. 1 foot inside the threshold of the question, we encounter the frustration of having asked it, which, as it turns out, doubles as the essence of the answer that such a question corresponds to. What is hoodoo? First, we have to make a distinction between hoodoo and voodoo. Voodoo is a religion and bears the hallmarks of religion. For example, it has a hierarchy and there are processes by which one becomes initiated as a practitioner or priest or priestess. Hoodoo is a belief system. It has no hierarchy and there is no formal initiation or ordination process for individuals who devote their lives to working with it. In the part of the South where I grew up, there are 2 styles of voodoo, Haitian style and Algiers style, and there are 3 styles of hoodoo, which is 3 styles of hoodoo. Basic hoodoo, Algiers style hoodoo, which is the same as Algiers style voodoo, and spiritual church movement hoodoo. Already these categories are problematized because voodoo is not hoodoo, as I have just said clearly, and yet there it is. The second category of voodoo is considered by many as the same as the 3rd category of hoodoo. How can this be? And furthermore, I named 3 styles of hoodoo, but for each one of these names, there are other alternative names. No version is ever fixed. It is as if at the sight of the various versions, there is a door that is always revolving. For example, spiritual church movement hoodoo can also be called Christo Conjure. It can also be called simply Christianity, which of course invites in questions of recognizability. You know, this is Christianity, the focus on the family people today. In other words, when we talk about one form of hoodoo, we are talking about one site within a tradition littered with points of entry, particularized through notions of version, which constantly trespass itself with multiple flashes of recognition or names. We could spend a great deal of time talking about how the 2nd category of Southern voodoo is often considered the 3rd category of Southern hoodoo, even though it is absolutely clear this is, in fact, impossible. But for now, it suffices to say that in saying what this tradition is, we first must stand in the shadow light that the question cast and the liminal space which precedes it. So already perhaps you get that contradiction is key to this tradition of Hulu, and I think in part because of the phenomena of diaspora. Diaspora as an event which exists also as a parallel logic or metaphysic that continually reorganizes the borders between what is possible. And nowhere is this more evident than in the way language works in this tradition. Thinking of diaspora as a strategy for language, its cultivation, its manifestation, we could begin with the word Hoodoo itself. When you try to locate its etymological root, you run into speculations and arguments. Some insist it is a bastard word hatching from the Udu language, which is a complex constellation of tonal linguistic culture spanning Ghana to Western Nigeria. But the truth is, we don't know. Origin detaches from the specificity of location and becomes a continued performance of wandering. It is interesting to consider the word diaspora. The English word, as we know it, was coined in 1867 from the Greek dia, about, across, and spherin, to scatter, which links into the etymological history of the English word sprout. Thus we see tucked into the root ball of diaspora this notion of propagation, the kind of permaculture nature makes as it cleaves, decreates, seethes, and happens. The word diaspora makes its debut in English in the year 1867 as a result of Deuteronomy chapter 28, verse 25. And this translation of the verse in Deuteronomy, the word diaspora doesn't appear, but I think it gets the energy of what we're talking about across here. So here's the verse. Thou shalt go one way against them, and flee seven ways before them. Thou shalt be removed into all the kingdoms of the earth, and thou shalt be food unto all birds of the heavens. There shall be none to frighten the birds away from thy remains. Jeez, some people are so intense. This verse, with the birds, etc., puts me in mind of Hitchcock's film, The Birds. The ways American horror films embody the American nightmare, a response to the American dream, that notion made especially popular after World War II to present the idea of privatization as freedom, as a reward, the birthright of the birthright, what we get for being who we are. One of the ways the notion of patriot gets slipped into identity, only to wake later in some of us, in many of us, in the form of sobbing, what to do with accountability in terms of national identity. What to do about anything? About having an origin we cannot return to for either political, logistical, existential, or other reasons. Thinking of the sky burial of our anxiety and the birds who take us to the four corners and small beak-sized stitches and in so doing continue our wandering, our scattering, I am interested in how diaspora mirrors the nature of language, is language, and is also a strategy for generating language, for text making. Writing as diaspora, as the continual performance of origin, when origin cannot be remembered as a separate event from the act of wandering. Writing as such is a writing that celebrates the question rather than privileging the answer at the expense of possibility. The question becomes a mode of engagement. A kind of consciousness is cultivated, which is not fixed on revealing a limit, and it is a spectrum-based consciousness. To experience this can be painful, very painful, or pleasurable, or both. But regardless of what it is, in its structure, we find, among other things, the blueprint essence of dream logic. To return to that notion of dream, as in the American dream, it is interesting if, for example, you believe that writers have dreams for culture, and that in so doing they present alternatives to paradigms which are grossly limited. The alchemical chamber of the dream form can present alternatives to binary opposition, which as a model and as a mode of engagement requires oppression to keep its wheels spinning. The dream form is not subject to categorical limits or the limits of answers. It is something that our poems and stories sometimes show us. With the medium of language, it is possible to put your hands in the very guts of ambiguity, and therefore to learn a little bit more about how to bear uncertainty. I'm reminded of Kafka, who wanted literature to wreck him, to be an axe breaking up the frozen sea within him, a literature that didn't escape him away from the pain of uncertainty, but delivered him more deeply into the poignant questions which gather at its edges. Language, as Derrida and others have suggested, and furthermore in much fancier ways than I am doing now, is an unstable medium, haunted with the possibility of never arriving, bloated with an internal sense of drift. And voice, I think, wants to commit the act of border trespass. And when we risk letting go of our attachment to recognizing ourselves, who we think we are or should be in our work, we often at last uncover what the work is. This was my experience when, for example, with my second novel, I started out suggesting to myself and others that I was writing a book about a band of gypsies having magical adventures and love stories in a faraway land that I would characterize as, quote, groovy. But instead ended up writing a book about the sex lives of teenagers set against a burned-out, post-industrial, apocalyptic, pastoral backdrop. It is a funny book, but it is also about the ways we get out of our bodies and the strange and sad things we do to get back in them again. So much for feeling groovy. Diaspora, wandering, trespassing, continuing. Recalling discipline through that hoodoo idea of skillful will, showing up, working with what you've got to create the most poignant outcome, and in thinking about oracle, the uncertain side of the question, perhaps one version of writing, as I discussed with my students recently, is when discipline and oracle become lovers inside of our lives, our processes, our investigations, and finally our texts. But back to this word hoodoo. Hoodoo functions as a noun, verb, and adjective. You can be a hoodoo, you can get hoodoo, you can perform hoodoo, and something can be hoodoo. So, for example, the sentence, she's got the hoodoo. Does the sentence mean she is a hoodoo, meaning one who performs hoodoo for herself or on behalf of clients or others? Does it mean she has been hoodooed, meaning someone has laid a trick or a blessing on her? Or does it mean she is hoodoo in the sense that she demonstrates a certain essence that is very particular? Perhaps she can either attract or repel the attention of others. You have to translate the sentence in order to know, and it is possible that it means all of the possibilities just listed and at once, entirely feasible. I'm reminded of this older lady who was a cashier at a gas station I met in Parma, Idaho, who was wearing a muumuu. She had this giant button on pinned to her muumuu that said multidimensional and loving it. Anyway, you probably know someone like that who is all those hoodoos at once. That person may even be you. Do you have to be inside the culture to successfully translate the function of the word hoodoo in this sentence? Do you have to be in the know in order to know? When I say, she's got the hoodoo, can you tell by the way I said it what I mean? Is translation only a performance of context? Only, you might say. Well, that is a big topic, translation. And about it, I will only say one small thing, that certainly the uncertainty of context haunts translation. What is lost while we carry meaning across? What was lost across the unstable border of the sea when the slave ship sailed across the ocean to the southern United States? How did the unstable medium of language accommodate, reflect, and embody that loss? How does, just in the way we speak about things, an ordinary sentence hold countless tones of loss? And how does this loss collect and essentialize to become the blank spaces between the words that we write? All of which is to say, what I am interested in is how translation reveals the animal body of memory, the muscular gestures just beneath the surface, the keening place where the insides begin. and our efforts to understand context and our efforts to achieve location, we enter the mode of translation, which paradoxically staves off understanding in the normal ways, because something is lost when it crosses over into the realm of other meanings. And let me be clear, by lost, I mean only changed. Language allows and reflects both absence and presence. Silence isn't the opposite of language, but one of its many aspects. Strangely, it is as if language is trying to communicate something to us about the way we behave. If you examine the kind of poetic forms that arise after atrocity, for example, it suggests language is telling us something about the way we have behaved. There is information in the forms that we cultivate to speak our loss. Translation as a strategy for engaging with language, as a strategy for writing, invites us to consider the installation space of the page itself, how our words hang on it, and how the gaps between them create vistas into silence. I believe this is true whether we are dealing with poetry or prose. Form and content converse. Diaspora, translation, wandering, scattering, continuing, memory. The elders that I engage with in the Hoodoo tradition are real sticklers for getting a recipe right. Say, for example, you are making up a rite that requires you use the word hyssop, the herb hyssop. You better be able to recite the 51st Psalm, all of it, and you better know why you better be able to, all the reasons why. Tremendous emphasis is placed on remembering a recipe properly. And to recite a recipe properly, you have to tell a story. And in that story, you have to genuflect the stories that encircle it. You have to know all the stories or strive to know all the stories. And so recipes turn into mandalas that lead to other mandalas. If you forget the story of hyssop, then you forget what the recipe means, its application. And if you forget what the recipe means, you forget the history that the winners of history failed to record. And if you lose that thread, you lose your direct line to the ancestors. And if you don't know the ancestors, you can't feed them. And if you can't feed them, they can't feed you. And this reciprocity of feeding comes in handy in life. For example, when you feed the ancestors your grief, they feed you praise. They replenish in you a sense of celebration. And then you can go on, even if you have lost a great deal. But our struggle to remember, and those moments in which we cease to, is of course subject to contradiction. Mother Harriet once told me a story, a version of an African story that had been passed down in her family, and the story goes like this. You must remember the names of the ancestors. You must be able to recite their names like a poem. And when you can't remember the names of the ancestors, when no one can remember the name of an ancestor, and that name no longer exists in human memory anywhere, then that ancestor begins to disappear from heaven, slowly, like a light that is dimming. And when the ancestor dims completely, he is no longer in heaven. He has lost his place in heaven. And then he turns into a butterfly, and then the butterfly disappears. Even though we struggle against loss, it is inevitable, and even the places we can't see into because of loss, well, the story goes on elsewhere. Memory as a form of diaspora, which has a limit that we can't see, and this too is recognized and honored. So in Hoodoo, memory functions as a portal to put you in filterless engagement with uncertainty. Memory is a defense against loss, and simultaneously, memory performs as a celebratory dance in honor of it. Memory doesn't necessarily prevent or halt loss, despite its dramatic gestures and insistence on recitations. It explores loss and gives it form. And thus it is in Hoodoo that it is possible to remember what you don't know. As I said earlier, there is no formal ordination process for practitioners of Hoodoo. No one is ever going to say to someone, now I pronounce you as official. I pronounce you as one who has visions, who dreams for the community, for culture, as one who co-creates with mystery the making of this world. Instead, it's put other ways. They say that if you have the special capacity to remember what you don't know, then you are, quote, gifted for the work. and it does make me think about writing. There is no standard ordination process for being pronounced as a real writer. Who can give you such permission? Permission to have dreams for culture? Could the affirmation of a teacher, of your friends, could a book deal, could a prize, could a claim tell you that you are real, that you are a real live writer? By what mechanisms do you claim this work? Who are you? To deal with such a daunting question, you may want to obtain a jar of honey, a piece of paper, and if you are the Bible type, a copy of the 23rd Psalm. You should begin by asking this question as clearly and as detailed as possible, which requires understanding your situation or dilemma, your motivations, which cultivates accountability. And it is crossing the threshold of accountability which initiates one into a very deep experience of authentic empowerment. Empower, it should be noted, at its etymological root, means to be able. And there is evidence that early usage of the word power corresponds to notions of luck. And it is this kind of luck that I wish each writer in this room. So on that note, good luck. Thank you.
How do you hold those two things that are both true and both regenerative at the same time? I don't know.
Well, I think, you know, in the tradition that I'm using kind of as a metaphor to suggest a series of strategies about text and text making and those types of things, it's so drenched in contradiction that the categories which organize our anxiety, such as time of past, present, future, old, new, kind of collapse. So hoodoo is a blend of traditions. It's always allowing and setting boundaries for itself and trespassing them. So I think of that, applying that as a strategy for language. I mean, the question is, how do we as writers hold the contradictions? There are techniques and strategies we can employ in our work, but I think that work also begins before we ever get to the page, you know?
Thank you.
Thanks so much for that talk. I have two questions. One is, who are the writers who you would say employ strategies, these strategies you talked about, in their work?
Mm-hmm. Well, Yabez comes to mind. Edmund Yabez comes to mind immediately. Embracing contradiction as a source of energy. The Dutch scholar, hermeneutic scholar, Mieke Ball, talks about writers and artists who, instead of avoiding the gap or the inconsistency or the break, target those moments as places of energy. And so you can look at, it's interesting, for example, to look at even ancient texts which have been redacted, that have had many editors, and the gaps that are created there as, on one hand, problematic, but on the other, very, very exciting because they rupture continuity. So, I mean, I think ancient texts actually are an interesting place to look. And also, I mean, I would say Myeongmi Kim, the poetry of Myeongmi Kim does that, of Elizabeth and many, many folks. Yeah.
Thank you. The second part of my question is back to the convergence or syncretism of hoodoo, and you talked specifically about African-American, Native American, and what I imagine then were a series of European-American cultures coming into white American identity, maybe not. And that particular period during the, did you say the antebellum South or during slavery? Can you talk about what you might, if you think that that kind of syncretism is happening right now in the United States. Even though there's an abundance of different cultures, there's not the same kind of push to the margins and the same kind of shared economic, well, maybe there is. So there's a lot of similarities between different cultures today as there were then, but there seems like some kind of condition for intimacy is not there, or exchange for language and exchange. And I just want to know what you thought about that, what kind of made that particular historical moment in the United States be that moment for this syncretism to occur, and do you see a correlation happening on any level, today in 2007?
You know, this idea, I think, of intimacy is really fascinating. One thing that my class was talking about was working with this idea of intimacy as a willingness to be exposed in the middle of your process, which, of course, invites or maybe requires us to have an openness towards dissonance, towards what is other. And so I think one of the things, like for me, looking at hoodoo, I'm always asking myself a series of questions. How do I engage with dissonance really when no one's looking, you know? And you know, enter into that kind of flow of accountability. And you know, in terms of why it happened and at that particular moment, interesting to note that, you know, all of the strands, Native American, Creole, Western and Eastern European strands of slave culture, these were all marginalized cultures in different ways. And so there was a way that these cultures were separate, and there was a way that the energy of skillful will, you know, working with what you've got to create the most poignant outcome, created the conditions conducive for a synergy to arise and kind of inform to be this tradition. And does that happen now? In this tradition of hoodoo is still very much practiced. And so in that sense, it continues. And I would have to really think about examples of where that's happening. I mean, I think there is a way where we are having an intimacy crisis. So, which, you know, it's important to understand why that is, and also to ruminate upon why that's interesting. So, I don't know if that answers your question. But.
Yeah, that did. That was great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Nick Morris? I know you said the information on hoodoo is primarily oral. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if there are other sources, books or documentaries that you may have come across?
Mm-hmm. In the 20s and 30s, an Anglican minister named Harry Hyatt, a white man from the Northeast, went down to Mississippi, Louisiana, South Carolina, Georgia, and interviewed thousands of hoodoo root workers. And collected their 5 volumes over 5,000 pages, which are direct transcriptions, which is the only recorded material. These books go for $5,000 as a complete set. They reprinted them in the 70s, and even those go for almost $3,000. And which is interesting for a whole bunch of reasons. You know, like the people who would benefit from those books, you know, couldn't afford them. But nonetheless, actually, Cat Ironwode If you Google Lucky Mojo Curio Company, it will take you to her website. And she has, I think, over 5,000 pages on the web where she has this massive archival project where she is preserving these recipes. And it is a fabulous resource, and there's sound recordings, and it's just like it's a mandala. It's like it opens and discloses into another opening and so on. I very much recommend that website.
Lucky Mojo Curio Company
was a company that was started in the 20s, and there's a huge Jewish strain in voodoo that I didn't even get into talking about, and in part that is because Jewish chemists, drugstore owners, would sell or manufacture and sell products to the voodoo community. And so, so then these kind of other strands of information begin to inform the tradition. So Cat Ironwood bought the rights to the original Lucky Mojo Curio Company and is still producing their authentic recipes with their labels. It's really amazing work that she's done in that field.
Thanks. Right, in Dalton, Tuesday. Is this ritualized poetry, or poetry which has become a religion, or is it a religion? It seems to me that what you're describing sort of goes on in so many different kinds of practices, in so many different cultures. So in some cases, they're called art, some cases, religion, and so forth. So, this works if you know certain kinds of specialized texts from Protestant Bibles, things like this. And I understand why is this interesting?
Why is it interesting?
Yeah.
I think because for me on a personal level, it's not religion. It's anti. There's a lot of argument around that within the existing communities that practice this.
Is it anti-religion?
It's not anti-religious, uh-huh. but it itself is not a religion. It's a belief system. It would be more like the Tao, say, than Catholicism. I mean, that's kind of not an appropriate comparison, but just it's a way, and it's a strategy for engaging with the difficulties of your life in a direct way. And so the way that language reflects that, I think, is fascinating, and that there are generative strategies within it for how we think about our own texts. So, does that answer?
Yeah, I like the quotation about how a Hoodoo person is one who dreams for the community, which is so interesting. Because you find that in some new societies and cultures, that Hoodoo is that kind of person.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it makes me think off topic, but of Zen monks who, the point that is to write until you don't have to write anymore, and the gesture of writing being the act of engaging with the ultimate mystery,
Hello, Sam.
Hi, Sam.
Sam Knights for the archives. Yesterday, when I was driving to the Bullet Theater, I was cut off by a car that had a license plate that said Hoodoo. I think it was Texas license plates. Do you drive such a vehicle?
No. I do not drive such a vehicle. Never cut off anyone in my life driving, I'm sure. But interesting, the word hoodoo has also been a word that's been very much kind of projected by Hollywood and kind of tourist traps in New Orleans, and it's interesting to see how it appears in culture and sometimes when it appears right in front of your car.
Yeah, I've had a circular experience the last 2 weeks, so I'm not surprised by this talk. In our class, we talked about how we can go through the back door of our own consciousness in order to write or release our intelligence from its own ghetto. Mm-hmm. And I was connecting that while you were talking about hoodoo and wondering if hoodoo acts also as a method around the constraints of the intellect.
Yes, I mean, it does, I think. It's interesting because hoodoo is a tradition which uses binary opposition as a way to pitch itself past the limitations of it. So there's a lot of talk, for example, of good and evil, you know, and you could get some conditional, I control my man, or I control my woman, or, you know, there are all of these kind of products and recipes that good, bad, right, wrong. But yet there's the nature of the contradiction, which kind of saturates the tradition, understands that in the end it's about spectrum-based consciousness, which is a mode of knowing that happens past the limits of such categories. So it's very much of this world. It understands the pain of being categorized, of categories, sees the usefulness of them, and also seeks to kind of have an other experience. And so I think to answer your question, it's not an intellectual tradition. It's a material-based tradition. And so other modes of knowing are celebrated. So it's, and the intelligence is celebrated, but so is the sound that the body makes when it's grieving or rejoicing, and these types of things. So there is an invitation to kind of release yourself from your intellectual abilities to know in these other ways.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Anne Kubiak, and I wanted to say hoodoo is also a Dutch word. It just means how's it going, basically.
Oh, interesting.
So, I really enjoyed what you're saying about the birds, the images of the birds carrying away the bodies. And that reminded me of psychopomps, and it seems like it opens up like an alchemical trance, you know, like a rebirth sort of situation. So in light of what we're talking about in the panel about revolution, I was just wondering if you could talk a little more about patriotism and duty and creating medicine for a cultural change through dreaming.
Sam and actually and I were having a discussion about, you know, what is the political form, how do we make our writing political, or, you know, all these kinds of things that come up in the road book. And I, you know, just, I guess to go back, whether we explicitly or not invest our work with ethical considerations, I mean, it happens. The question isn't, does it happen or does it not happen, but are we conscious of it, you know? And so to go back to that idea of the form of the dream, which can engage with taboos, and the surrealists knew this, and the text of the surrealist, which so, in such a keening way, critiqued social structures and offered alternatives to those structures. And it's the form of the dream which can do that. And so I think how that maybe logistically translates to our writing process, you know, practicing awareness about what is our relationship between our form and our content, and what way do they, are they conversing with one another to suggest what, and, you know, what personal, where's our limit in our work, where's our limit as writers, an important question to ask, why don't we go beyond it? And if we do go beyond it, are we willing to leave our bag of tricks at the door, so to speak? You know, those things that we're very good at and sometimes develop these kind of codependent relationships upon in our work. You know, like, oh, I can do this syntax thing. It works every time. But, you know, like, when are you willing to leave that at the border and trespass into the unknown? So I think there's a way that language dreams. It's a dreaming medium. And I think it's interesting the way that medium and subsequent forms kind of remind us of what is possible.
Hi, Kaylee Farah. I was wondering if you could maybe elaborate on some of the similarities between like themes and consciousness and tradition with other spiritual practices or religions, and kind of where the groundwork is, the framework that kind of fits all of them together, because I'm very interested in exploring spiritual things and trying to make connections between them myself. And I was wondering if you could give me a couple of hints to look for.
kind of done my research.
So are you asking what connects all religions?
Some of the themes that you see reoccurring with other practices that you've explored.
Right. Well, I mean, this is not a very, I feel, thoughtful answer to your very, I think, serious, good question. But, you know, I think death, birth, resurrection, pain, loss, wandering.
The human experience.
You know, all these themes, I think many traditions deal with them. You know, this idea, too, of karma, you know, of the golden rule. And also karma as this idea of work, don't you think it's interesting that you literally have to pay to exist? As if it's not hard enough. You know, you better come with cash, you know? And so I think these, you know, all traditions deal with these themes, in different ways. They're nuanced differently. And there's dissonance, between different traditions. But I think that dissonance is potentially also very generative. So I don't think that answers your question.
Thank you for sharing. That was a wonderful topic.
I see one. I have a sort of inchoate curiosity, and that's I've been thinking about, because you brought up silence at one point as not non-language but an aspect of language, and silence can be experienced as listening and as volitional or as repressive. Mm-hmm. And also I was thinking that in relation to the orality, the importance of an oral performance of certain kinds of literature, and then the way you're talking about hoodoo, that things must be said, mm-hmm. but they sound more like recitations than mm-hmm. And that kind of mandala movement around, and also the mandala movement around a necessary ambiguity and unstatedness. So I was wondering about the performativity and sort of performative speech acts, where you might say, you know, like when you marry someone, I take you to be my spouse. Mm-hmm. Do you say, I bless you, or I hex you mm-hmm. in this, or is that a necessary silence, and how, then what relation does the saying aloud of a text mm-hmm. have to that as making real, mm-hmm. making audible, or making material, like that you write on paper and put in honey? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also what relation text might have, like how does the 23rd Psalm relate to
right.
mm-hmm. productivity in a whorehouse?
But aren't you glad to know that it does? Well, yeah, I do want to just say that, you know, silence, right, double-edged sword. I mean, it can be a terrible thing and a necessary thing and a good thing. So, you know, you ask, do you say, I take this woman to be my wife, or I bless this woman? In hoodoo, there are many, many words, and they're all similar. There's this idea of variation kind of infesting similarity. So, for example, lighting candles is big in the hoodoo tradition, but there are 13 different words you can pick from to use to say how you're going to light that candle. You know, I'm going to set it, I'm going to butt it, I'm going to knock it, you know, and so on and so on. It's that idea of tuning into where are you resonating in the spectrum, you know, that mirror of accountability. What are my motivations? What is my situation? What is my kind of dilemma? Yes. Oh, very much so, and absolutely performative, very performative. And in hoodoo, and I think in writing, and I think I'm investigating the bridge between these two kind of things. When you're making a prayer or a blessing, a lot of times, you know, people get very worked up. They go into trance states, And the reason for that being is that you want what you're saying, what is kind of resonating on, you know, an intellectual level, it has to drop its tendrils into emotion in order to become activated as power. And I think, you know, in writing, I find that, you know, I have to be able, the sentence has, it has to drop its tendrils down into some type of guts, you know, and be energized and mean. It has to be more than clever, you know. It's great that if it is clever, you know, but, you know, I want it for me to resonate in other ways as well. So the performative aspect, there's very much a performative aspect, and I experience that in my own writing when I'm by myself at my desk and not speaking out loud. Pardon? There's no God, there's no right or wrong. I mean, there is one of the categories of hoodoo is called the spiritual church movement, and that is where hoodoo does merge with Christianity. So there are versions of hoodoo that work in a context of religion. But in a basic general sense, it's a series of strategies for dealing with life. And, you know, seeing the light and the dark, you know, at the same time. And how do you deal with that? And it translates in very practical ways. How do you have a pain in, you know, the neck, neighbor? What are you going to do about it? You know, or, you know, your boss is trying to, you know, mess you up. What are you going to do about it? You know, and these types of things. So it has a real practical application, but one that is coming from a spectrum-based consciousness. So I would say I would personally absolutely define it as a spiritual path, but it doesn't have the hallmarks of what we might define as a religion. In a general sense, spiritual church movement is different. You know, spiritual church movement hoodoo is really big on Jesus, but Jesus not in the maybe traditional sense. You know, the Jesus that performs the miracles, that turns the waters into wine, you know, the hoodoo practitioner will resonate with that, you know, in their own kind of recipe making.
So. Richard Schwartz, this isn't exactly my question, but budding, setting, and knocking the light all means the same thing, or it means different things in different contexts?
It's the same gesture, you're lighting a candle, but it insinuates where you are kind of, like if you imagine, like, you know, here's an arc, and this arc means lighting the candle. Are you shimmering here, or are you shimmering here? So it's about, like, checking in with your motivations and aligning yourself with the energy of language that corresponds to that as a way to be clear.
Could you just speak quickly to the Native American thread in the shaman tradition, and specifically the Two-Spirit tradition, perhaps? Is there a representation of hoodoo there?
Native American traditions, in particular where I'm from, Cherokee and Choctaw, there was a great sharing of herbal knowledge, and so there was an exchange of information. And so, for example, slaves would engage with Native Americans post Reconstruction, and, you know, there was a synergy in the way that they engaged with plants, and so you may have seen on the bottom dusty shelf of some drugstore in some small town somewhere something called Indian Money House Blessings. You know, that's a hoodoo product, not a very high quality one, but you know, so there's this way that the figure of the Native American has become a representation of possibility in terms of the new tradition.
Well, that's about the Two-Spirit, because obviously that's
where the
minor.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, they're definitely in conversation. Well, thank y'all so much for your patience.